And on the line, I have that man who's always looking upwards, yes, Dr. Martin George. How are you this morning, sir?
Pretty good, thanks, Brian. How are you?
Oh, lots of things happening. Good, keep busy. Out of mischief.
Oh, good.
Now, you've been a little bit of a trip to some warmer place. Let's hear all about it.
Indeed, yeah. The main purpose of the trip I just took was to go to the International Planetarium Society conference in Japan in a place called Fukuoka, way down in the southwest on the island of Kyushu. Sorry. And there were about 600 people there, half of whom were Japanese, and it provided a great opportunity for us all to network with the Japanese and for the Japanese people to network with us, and it was just absolutely great. And there were a number of really good sessions, but frankly, the one that comes to mind most of all is one about planetariums as second responders. And I was quite fascinated to go along to that session. And the speaker spoke about the planetariums being places for people to go after some kind of natural disaster, such as a hurricane or something like that, after they've had their first responses, you know, medical aid, housing and psychological aid and so on, to go to a planetarium as a really peaceful, interesting environment to settle them down a lot more. And we certainly think of planetariums as places that promote peace and are very, very peaceful. But this was a really focused one about recovery from some major event and going in and looking at the night sky and thinking about how we're all together on Earth and how we must look after the Earth and so on. So I found that quite fascinating. We also had a session on the planetariums over the next 100 years, what's going to happen, because you might remember that last year we celebrated 100 years since the very first public planetarium show, which was held in Germany in 1925. And looking forward to the next century, what's going to happen? Are people still going to go to planetariums? What will planetariums be like, especially after 100 years? Well, it's hard to predict what technology we're going to have 100 years from now, but there was a general consensus that we will still be operating planetariums, possibly more than ever. And going back to that theme of planetariums being peaceful places where people can really enjoy themselves and get together with the rest of the audience under the simulated starry sky, I commented that I'd be hoping that planetariums are a major factor in world peace over the next 100 years. We live on a little planet. It might seem big to us, but it's a tiny, as Carl Sagan once said, a pale blue dot, a tiny place in the universe. And it's a place we need to contemplate, a fact we need to contemplate. There's so much else out there, and there's so much other than us on Earth to think about in the whole universe. So there was that topic as well. And I was also invited to give a night sky talk about the skies of Tasmania, which was great, in one of the planetarium domes there. And there were several of us doing that from our own perspective. There was somebody from Spain and people from other parts of the world. And of course, I promoted Tassie as a great place to look at the night sky. I didn't really need to for planetarium professionals, but many of them had not seen the southern sky before, not experienced the view that you get from this latitude. And that's something we noticed in 2006 when we held the IPS conference in Melbourne. There were a lot of people seeing the far southern Milky Way for the first time. And it is really spectacular, Brian. It's fantastic.
Yeah, you can see the whole world from a different perspective when you said, for instance, what's going to happen in 100 years. You know, the bigger picture. And I think, as you say, we're only a very small planet, but to see it from another point of view is hopefully going to be good. There is somebody out there looking at us. You
know? Indeed.
Yeah. Anyway, next is the 50th anniversary of the first successful landing on Mars.
Yes, indeed. Coming up next Monday, July the 20th, looking back to 1976 on the 20th of July, that's when Viking 1 touched down on the surface of Mars, and it was really the first successful Mars landing. And there was another companion craft that landed a few months later called Viking 2, hardly surprising. But it was a very famous moment when we first saw on the TV news that picture of the surface of Mars, it came through in black and white at first, and there was the foot pad of the Viking 1 lander. This, of course, was a United States mission. And it was the Viking 1 lander's foot pad, together with various rocks and dust on the surface of Mars. And it wasn't long, next day, in fact, I think it was, before we had the first colour picture of the surface of Mars. Now, of course, we know that Mars is called the red planet, and it's red because basically its surface is rusty. And that red colour showed up very, very well in those early Viking 1 pictures. And it was a fascinating mission. Both the Viking 1 and Viking 2 sent back lots of data about the conditions on the surface of Mars. But gradually, over that week beyond July the 20th, 1976, we saw more and more pictures from the surface of Mars, and more data. Data came through. The Viking 1 lander measured the highest temperature at its site as minus 14 Celsius. Mars is not Mars is a rather cold planet, and it got down to minus 77 at night. And so it's nothing like the sort of temperatures we experience on Earth, despite the fact that Mars is called the red planet and you might think of it as hot. No, it's not. Now, Viking 1 lasted for several years. In fact, it lasted longer than Viking 2. Now, we're talking here about the landers. They each had orbiters orbiting overhead as well, taking pictures of Mars, but the landers captured the most public attention. Viking 2, which touched down in September 1976, failed on April the 12th, 1980. And that was simply because its batteries failed. But Viking 1, interestingly enough, lasted another couple of years. It failed on the 11th of November, 1982. So we had 6 years of data coming back from Viking 1. But the reason it failed was human error. One day there was an instruction to send up code to charge the batteries. So to tell the computer to charge the batteries up using its mechanisms and solar panel and so on and so forth. And the I think they also had a plutonium power source on there. But the operator who sent the instructions up to charge the batteries sent it to the wrong part of the computer memory accidentally and wrote over the instructions as to how to point the antenna to the Earth. So as soon as that instruction reached the craft, it probably charged up its batteries, but we never heard from it again. So that was really sad. Yes. That there was that human error. Imagine being the operator sending up that instruction and then suddenly realizing, oh no.
Whoops.
Yeah, I don't know that that's exactly happened, but imagine if you were that person who suddenly realized what you'd done.
Yes.
Oh, dearie me. But 6 years and of data about the conditions on Mars, the images from the surface and so on, and very, very highly successful missions. Now, I use the word successful here because they weren't the first landers to touch down on Mars. There was a Soviet probe called Mars 3 that landed on the surface earlier, but failed very, very soon after landing. It was trying to transmit a picture, and the picture that the Soviets got was just a picture of static. It didn't form an image at all, and then the lander fell dead. So I wouldn't call that successful, but technically, if you wanted to think about the first actual landing of a spacecraft on Mars, soft landing, in other words, without crashing, the Soviets did beat the Americans, but the Americans certainly had the first really successful ones. Absolutely spectacular missions, and of course, we've had many missions since then as well, including two rovers that are still operating on the Martian surface right now.
Yes, so you've got to have some success occasionally, but unless you send back the pictures, why did you send it in the first place? But that's another story. Well, let's get to what's currently happening in the evening sky on the northwest of Tassie.
Well, we've got a brilliant view of the planet Venus, which is brilliant. It's the brightest point of light in the night sky. It's over there in our northwest, and we've had several people at the planetarium asking about Venus, and they've been watching it even in the twilight. So if you look up high in the northwestern sky in the twilight, even against a blue sky, you can see it not long after sunset. In fact, technically, it's visible even with the sun in the sky if you know exactly where to look. You've got to look at the precisely correct direction in the evening sky, or in the daytime sky, as a matter of fact, because even around midday you can see it. But it's in the evenings that it's so brilliant. It reflects much more light than any other planet does. We see the planets, of course, Brian, only because the sun is shining on them, That's why we see the moon as well. That's where the light comes from. So that's the brilliant point of light in the northwest. But now that we have no moon in the evening sky at the moment, and we are in July, August, they are the best months to be looking at the Milky Way. High in the east, we have the constellation of Scorpius, and the Milky Way passes very close to the Scorpion's tail. Higher up in the south, over to the right, through the pointers and the Southern Cross, and then down again into the western part of the sky. And it really is an absolutely magnificent sight. As I was mentioning, I gave a talk about the current night sky from Tasmania to planetarium colleagues in Japan who wish they could be in Tasmania at this time of the year. And I think some of them are planning a trip to Tassie to get that beautiful, beautiful view. So don't forget, if you've got a pair of binoculars, you can see many more stars in the Milky Way. Especially interesting is the area around the tail of the Scorpion, which is that constellation that looks like a question mark seen in a mirror. And you can see two stars very close together that form part of the stinger at the end of his tail. Scanning around there, there are some beautiful star clusters, and a bit below the tail as well. And the other great place to look is to the right and down a bit from the Southern Cross, on the opposite side to where the pointers are. There are lots of lovely star clusters in that area, including one of my favourite ones called NGC 3532. Not a fascinating name, but it's a beautiful cluster that shows up brilliantly in a pair of binoculars. So get those binoculars out tonight, have a good look through the Milky Way, and you'll be amazed at what you can see.
It's just, it blows me away every time we come up with this, and what's actually up there and what people can actually see without a telescope. But it's great.
Indeed, the view with the unaided eye is absolutely brilliant. Get away from the lights of towns and cities, though.
Yes, very important. And as always, thank you very much for your time this morning. And it's always something I learn every time I talk to you. It's brilliant.
Thanks, Brian. Always a pleasure. Bye for now. Talk to you again soon.
Yeah, Dr. Martin George from the Hive Planetarium in the beautiful Alveston. So check it out. Always good.